I'm Al Perry, and this is a KXCI Conversation. This is Al Perry, and my guest today in the studio is Mr. Jeff Emmerich. He worked with a fellow named George Martin and this little rock band called The Beatles. He was the principal recording engineer starting at about Revolver, but was with them from the very beginning. He ushered in a new era of recording and production that introduced a lot of experimentation into what was a relatively staid industry. Now, I understand you started with The Beatles very young.
No, I did very, very young. I started at EMI Studios. I know we get confused with this, which has now become Abbey Road Studios, so I'm going to refer to it as EMI Studios in 1962. And I first entered the doors on whatever date it was, and The Beatles started to come in the 2 days after I started. And that was to record, I think it was How Do You Do It by, I'm maybe wrong on that, by Mitch Murray. Right? I don't, you might. And then Lennon made a comment at the end of that session, because I was standing in on the session just to get to, you know, learn the ropes of the way that my job was going to be. And Lennon made a remark about, no, we want to record our own material. So George Martin said, well, you know, what have you got? So John, they went through three renditions of Love Me Do. But because of the time restraint in the studios at that time, we had to finish at 10 o'clock in the evening. So another studio was booked, or another session was booked for like two weeks later. And that was when Andy White played on the version of Love Me Do to bring in a new drummer, no, rather than Ringo. So they re-recorded, you know, Love Me Do. But anyway, I was there like 2 days before they came into EMI.
How old were you when you started?
By that stage, nearly 16. I was 15. You know, I lied about my age.
So you became the head engineer at the time of Revolver. How old were you then?
19.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Now, I went up the ladder really fast because I was actually remastering American records for Europe. Obviously, someone thought there's some potential in Jeff, and people were thinking behind the scenes we want a younger person involved with recording. Because most recording engineers, I know there's a few younger ones there, were like 35 or 40 years old, right? So when I entered the doors, they said, well, you know, if you're lucky, you know, you'll go up the ladder and you'll be this, you'll be that. But by the time you're 35 or 40, you may become a recording engineer. So that was, you know, the wow, you know, fantastic. But it just blew up in their faces, you know.
I think the Beatles were preferring a younger engineer.
Well, behind the scenes, that's what happened. Because, except Norman Smith, the original engineer, left, right? And Norman was a great engineer. And he left because he founded Pink Floyd. And I got on well with Norman. And I think what happened I don't think it was mentioned to the whole band that Norman was leaving. Because I know when I first started that first session on Tomorrow Never Knows for Revolver, some of the band didn't know that Norman had left. But I think behind the scenes, between management of EMI production people and so forth, that someone had mentioned, probably McCartney, we want a younger engineer involved. We don't want someone who's 50 years old. You know? Although Norman at that time was like 38, I think.
At
you know?
That time, that was ancient though, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, but I was a kid and I loved my music and stuff. But it stirred a lot of trouble up behind the scenes.
Because you were so youthful.
Well, no, that wasn't that. It was because the directive when I became their recording engineer, because I took over Norman's sessions when Norman left, and the first thing I made or recorded was Manfred Mann's Pretty Flamingo, which was a hit. And that was the first time I put a dobro guitar through a Fairchild 60 limiter. But no one ever heard the power of that dobro through that sound, you know? So anyway, one thing led to another. So I was taking over Norman's artists. And then one day, you know, the manager said, you know, can you come up to the office? And George Martin was there and he said, oh, Jeff, would you like to record the Beatles, right? And my heart sank. Being so young, I mean, so I played a little mind game, you know, a little ball that bounces back from yes to no, yes to no, yes to no, yes to no. And it was always on no, right? And then suddenly it went to yes, nothing to lose. And I went for it, you know. But the Tomorrow Knows session was like horrendous because, first of all, it wasn't the demand, but they didn't want this wishy-washy sound, right? Which the other engineers had been pushing out, which was fine, you know. They wanted something different. And I'd like to hear something different because I've been mastering American records and so forth, you know. So I altered all the drum techniques and so forth, got into terrible trouble for doing it because the thing was, we've been doing it for like 10 or 20 years like this. Why are you changing it? And so I got into terrible trouble over that, you know.
Breaking the rules.
Yeah, so I was breaking the rules, you know, building new barriers, you know.
Mm-hmm. And there's a famous story about that where John wanted to sound like the Dalai Lama on a mountaintop, and yeah, you were sort of put to the test at that point.
Well, yeah, that was the second demand. Well, that's keep using the word demand. It wasn't a demand. It was something I wanted to actually try and grab and create as well, because it started with Ringo's drums on that track, right, on Tomorrow Never Knows, and he wanted a more power in the drums. I want this, I want that. So obviously you move the mics back in, because the mics normally were up here, and so push, all of the mics down. Close mic the bass drum, took the front skin off, got the more powerful bass drum sound, put all the drums through a Fairchild 660 limit. I didn't know what I was doing, but I did. And it was like the most awesome drum sound. John's request was for the Dalai Lama vocal sound, you know, on a mountaintop 25 miles away from the studio. So my saving grace now is seeing that revolving Leslie speaker through the control room window from the Hammond organ. I thought, well, if we can cut into the circuitry of the revolving speaker, we can put John's voice through that, which we did. So John was like, awesome, you know. So I'd won them over that day. I mean, I was in a terrible state by the end of that session, you know?
So a lot of those things had never been done before, using a limiter like that.
I was abusing the equipment and overloading the equipment just to create more power and punch in recording.
And the other thing that's interesting, and this gets into something that I have a contention, that the engineer is equally as responsible as a producer or the artist with the final sound of the music. And oftentimes the engineer is just thought of as a technician. I don't believe that.
No, it's not true. That is not true. And I'm glad you said that, because, you know, we weren't even allowed to have credits on the albums, right? Even the guys that recorded all the operas and so forth, which was, because I used to work as an assistant engineer on some of the most amazing opera recordings as well. And I'm thinking, you can't get a credit on that album after all the work you've done, but the guy that took the picture on the front cover can, you know? But what normally happens is, you know, if it's a hit record, the producer gets the credit. If it's a bad record, this is the engineer's fault. No, seriously. And that was the attitude. But we weren't allowed, until the CDs came out, and I said to a guy called Basker Menon, who was the CEO of Capitol Records, and Basker was a nice guy, and I said, look, Basker, can you sort of undo an injustice that I've never been credited on the vinyl albums? Can you at least put my name on the CD albums? And he did.
Well, that's good. There's another story about you close miking the strings on Eleanor Rigby.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, again, that had as much, if not more, of an influence on the sound than any producer could have done, and you did that.
That's right, because, you know, every record today, when you get that up-close string sound, you know, wants that sound. And that in itself, from an artistic point of view, was a bit of a fight, because the strings on Eleanor Rigby was a double string quartet. You know, two desks of first, seconds, you know, violas, cellos. So there's eight people there and a cello and a bass, I think. I'm not quite sure about that. So I mic the strings by putting the condenser mic about an inch away from where the bow hit the strings on the thing. And I remember one of the older string players saying to me, you don't mic strings like that. You know, you grab the mic up here, like 6 foot away. So, no, we're after a different sound, right? So the second desk kept shifting away because we knew the sound was deteriorating as we were doing the run-throughs. And the second desk shifted away from the mics. So we looked down from the control room window from number two into the studio and realized they'd moved away. And then they had to go down and reposition the mics on the strings. So eventually we did get the take. And they were so incensed with the fact that you just don't record strings like that. We said, well, okay, we're going to play it back to you now, right? They walked out of the studio. They did not want to hear what we'd done. That's an MU thing. Right. And everyone tries to achieve that sound now, that bite and that attack, you know, on strings, on certain things. But the arrangement was based on Psycho. With the shower scene.
The stabs.
Because when it was discussed in front of Paul about Eleanor Rigby, George Martin said, well, what about, you know, strings? And Paul's thinking, everyone, it's like Mantovani and very lush strings, right? And then Paul and I discussed a different way of doing the recording the strings. So that's how we ended up with that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the last piano chord on the Day of the Life? I love how that
was the story
recorded.
That came about, we'd finished the last orchestral overdub the night we put the orchestra on. Paul, obviously, in his imagination, because Paul's the musician's musician, right? It wouldn't have been John that would have come up with this, right? So Paul said, obviously, in his mind, felt that we should have something to still end it. So there were so many guests in there. It was like a party in the studio. He said, let's do like an at the end, right? Put the mics on, get everyone to this crowd to just sing the right? So we tried it, but it didn't really work. So about a week later, it was decided, let's put a big piano cord on. So we had like four pianos, and I mic'd them in such a way, the gain on like the condenser microphones really lifted the volume of that last chord. And as the last chord was dying away, I sort of gradually lifted up the volume like this, more and more, until it was almost a point of feedback between the control room and the studio. So then we did another pass on that, right? But so I started off by playing the beginning of that about 10 seconds or 15 seconds later than the first one, so I could actually now crossfade them to lengthen them, and then do a third one and a fourth one. So that's why it's so long, but it really is like one, it goes to infinity, but because of the reissues, it doesn't really go to infinity. You can hear it cut off because there's a ring of shoe squeak at the end of the original, right? Which I can't even hear anymore. So someone is not aware of that and it's gone. So that was the end of a day in the life, you know?
Yeah, that's pretty amazing just how long that piano chord holds out.
No, absolutely.
And wasn't it all the different Beatles were all struck the piano?
Oh, yes, apart from George, I think it was. Yeah, it was. And I think Mal Evans may have played one, I'm not sure.
Right.
And George Martin played the harmonium because there's a slight buzz under the original record.
Yeah.
Because when they, in their wisdom, wanted to clean it up, the buzzer's gone, you know?
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about your feelings on modern recording techniques and digital and Pro Tools and all of those things, because we were talking about this earlier, and you were mentioning about the colors and just your whole philosophy of mixing and stuff. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
You know, digital came into being, and a certain way of working sort of happened. But what seems to happen to me... We created something, or the way I work, right, is the fact if a band's rehearsing in the studio, right, mm-hmm. they're running, which the Beatles did, running through a song, and they're using the instrumentation, my ear picks up on a tonality that is a combination of a few of those instruments, and it might be a high tone or a low tone or a middle tone, so that's like my dominant. So when we start sort of merging the different instruments together, I start tonality-wise merging them to complement the dominant tone that's on the record. And I think a good example, which is probably an easier one, is Band on the Run, which the McCartney album, because the upfront instrument, even louder than the voice, is the drums. Everything else complements the sound of the drum kit because it's very sparse, it's very open. And the drums are always up in your face. You know, they've never been like pushed back because of overdubs. But what's happening now, you know, people like painting by numbers because of plugins. You know, if the guitar sounds wrong, however they're working, they don't like get another guitar. They get a plugin to change the sound of that guitar, which is not right in the first place. And this is the way, you know, it started to
kind of seems
evolve.
Lazy, but it actually seems like it also is more effort to do it that way.
Yeah, but as I said,
get somebody to play the part again,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, but the tone of the guitar is wrong to start with.
Right.
And there was an example yesterday, and I won't say where it was. It was an example to some students somewhere, right? And they were listening to a sound of an acoustic guitar. And the teacher said, well, I think I'm going to compress this and re-equalize it. And I said, well, why? And he said, well, it didn't have enough body in it, and it didn't have this. And then someone picked up on it, because I never took it any further. Well, why didn't you change the guitar and record it with a microphone? Because he said it was DI'd. So it's stuff like that, you know?
Yeah, and it must be frustrating for you to being a master of things like mixing and stuff to just see these automated mixes and stuff like that.
No. The trouble is with automated mixes, it just becomes... just bland, you know, it's just a linear sound. And we go going into the realms of digital compression, which is like just squash the hell out of it, and it says like noise.
Yeah.
You can't individually pick out the instruments on everything anymore, like the percussion, two guitars, drums, bass, keyboards. It's just this horrendous noise, you know? And I think I said to someone else today about the fact that a lot of the young kids now, because I won't use auto-tune because I'm fortunate enough to work with real artists, right? And I refuse to use auto-tune. But there's a certain sort of breed of children that can speak as though they've got auto-tune on their voice.
Oh, my goodness.
Have you ever heard that?
I hope not.
No, they have. I've tried it. I can't do it. But they can actually speak with auto-tune on their voice.
Oh, God.
You haven't come across that.
I give up.
Well, me too.
Anyway, Jeff Emmerich, he was the engineer for the Beatles. Worked along with George Martin, pioneer of recording. It's a thrill to meet you, sir. And
no, nice to meet you, too.
It is so awesome to get to talk to you. You don't know how happy I am.
Oh, good, me too.
You made me today. So thank you so much for this.
You don't look that happy, right?
Thank you.
That's great. No, thanks a lot.
For more KXCI conversations, you can visit kxci.org.